Hey everyone, before we begin our Next Voices episode, I wanted to let you know that our Strengthening Couples Workshop is returning. It's facilitated by the fantastic Jenny Morrow. It is on February 28th from 9:30 a.m. to 12 o'clock, and it's $25 a person. It's a 2.5-hour workshop which will focus on helping couples strengthen their relationship amidst religious transition and change. You can come alone or you can come as a couple. However, just get yourself there if you feel that this will benefit you. They'll be discussing productive ways to work with the differences that might exist when a couple goes through this situation, including ideas for healthy communication. Please email me if you would like to take part in this and reserve a spot. My email is info@whitefieldseducational.org. And now back to Voices. Welcome back to Mormon Expression Voices. My name is Katrine, and today I'm excited to be with a brother and sister. We're with Susan, do you say Mowers or Mowers?
Mowers.
Mowers. Susan Mowers and her brother Joel.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having us.
Definitely.
Great. Now, who's older, Susan or Joel?
I am Susan.
And by how many years?
We're just about 10 years apart.
Oh, yeah. Good space.
Yeah.
To the month, I think.
Yep, exactly. Same month, just different days, but 10 years.
Okay, nice. And where did you both grow up?
We grew up in Reno, Nevada. I was actually born in Wisconsin. My parents lived in the Midwest when I was little, but they moved out here when I was really young. So, in essence, Reno the whole time.
Okay, so before Joel came along.
Yep.
All right. Do you have any other siblings?
We do. I'm the oldest of five, and so it's me and then two sisters and then Joel and another brother.
Okay. What was your background growing up in the church?
You know, and it'll be interesting to hear because mine, I'm sure, was different a little bit than Joel's, same in some ways, but I was about 3 or 4 when my parents joined the church. When our parents joined, our mom was Catholic and our dad was kind of, I don't know, was it Lutheran, Methodist, something, kind of just nothing too specific. But so they joined when I was 3. So, and I actually remember seeing them baptized.
Oh.
And I was back in Wisconsin and I was really young and it was just kind of this, you know, blur of things. But growing up, our parents, our mom especially, she had a really kind of a rough family life on her own and growing up. And so she really clung to the church. So when they were first baptized, like I just, everything was very, like, I think she tried to follow every rule that ever came down. And as the oldest, and I was almost an only child for a while, like I just remember even when she discovered like that she could go to the temple with my dad, I remember her taking all my my little tank tops and replacing them with t-shirts and, you know, just to make everything temple worthy, even though I was just a little kid. Like she was very, very orthodox, for me growing up. I remember being sealed to my parents. I was 4 or 5 and, they were sealed in Oakland, and I remember going and being in the little kids' room, and, you know, so that was kind of neat. You know, growing up for me, I'm the typical oldest child syndrome. So I was always like the super responsible one and always, I kind of, you know, I tease with my parents now and with my friends, I was the first pancake. So I kind of feel like everything was very strict for me. And then especially when it came to church stuff, like it was very like there's the one way to do it and there was no options, and mom always would talk to me about how she was always surprised, you know, when they were converts and they would hear something like you should pay 10% of your tithing or whatever they heard, they just were like, okay, let's do it. And they were always surprised that other people didn't. And you know, and I think they were at a vulnerable spot when church came into their lives. So I think they just really clung to everything and they wanted to do it like 100,000,000%. Like they just wanted to do it and believed it with all their heart and really passed that down. And so for me, I just always felt a lot of pressure. And then when I was in high school, I had a lot of, well, in Reno, there really wasn't like a big Mormon. There wasn't a lot of Mormon kids or families or anything like that. And there, those who were at church, like not, most of them were not active anyway, or they'd come, you know, they were like for the kids, they were like the Jack Mormon kids, like the guys would be out drinking and then the next day passing the sacrament because there was just, you know, the very few young men. So I had maybe one or two friends then growing up that were pretty, very active like me. And so we kind of clung together in high school and we had some, I mean, we had really good friends. My mom always, you know, made sure that we were running with the right crowds, but we did early, I remember early morning seminary. We lived way out of town too. We kind of lived in the boondocks and getting up at like 4:30 in the morning because I rode in with the seminary teacher whose daughter was my good friend. And we drive to the stake center and seminary is like 6 a.m. and she wanted to get there insanely early. And so.
Were you a rule follower then, like your parents?
Oh, you bet. Well, I was a rule follower, but I didn't always want to be. But for me, like the consequences were pretty strict if I didn't. So it got to the point where I just kind of stopped pushing back because pushing back was just would not get good results.
From your parents?
From my parents, yeah. They would really clamp down. And it's not like I had curfews and things, but it just was really just a lot of pressure. Like, you have to be the example. And growing up, I pushed back to my mom a lot, but she pushed back just, you know, even more and made things. It's not like there was abuse or it wasn't anything like that. It was just, it was that fear of mom, you know, that kind of gets struck in your heart when you're a kid. You're like, don't piss off mom or. So, yeah, and I was the Hermione in high school and everything, you know, having all the good grades and honor classes and yada, yada, yada. And I did that because I wanted to go to BYU. So.
Okay. So it sounds like you were the perfect eldest child.
Oh, totally. Like, I'm amazed that my brothers and sisters just don't gag with, like, the stories.
Well, we'll ask Joel if that's
perfect
true.
Perfect little Susan, you know.
Okay. So Joel, you were born into a family that had already accepted the gospel and you were born in the covenants.
Yep, I was. I grew up with a typical Mormon household. By the time, Susan was about 8 years old by the time I was born. So my parents had more than fully enrooted themselves into the, you know, the church doctrine and following all the rules there. And so, my upbringing was a little more, you know, typical of what you might see with, you know, other people who were just born into the church. You know, I grew up around family home evenings and going to church activities and all that. So a little bit different than what my sister, you know, grew up around. So for the rest of us kids, it was definitely a different parenting than what Susan had, for sure. I think by the time a lot of my siblings and myself were starting to get older, their attention in some ways wasn't focused on Susan where she needed it and wasn't and was focused on her when she didn't need it. And so, you know, I think she got the short end of the straw there for the parenting that in that sense. Just there was such an age difference, you know, with our kids, with our siblings. So, you know, the 10 years apart and then the other siblings are five and two and whatnot. And I suppose you see a lot of that in some of the larger Mormon households where they have, you know, the 11 children, just going to be just a massive age difference. And that can be, you know, nice, but it can also cause some problems with some of the parents who just don't, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to pay attention to the teenager that needs the attention when you still have the baby that needs to be.
Yeah, of course.
Taken care of.
You know, by the time I was 8 years old, Susan was already off of college. So, it was, kind of just, I remember, you know, just seeing my older sister and knowing about her and seeing her, you know, whenever she would, when I was really young, having memories of her. But then as I got older, it was, you know, whenever she came back home to visit, essentially. And then she went on her mission. And so there was just more time in between. So, you know, it's really been since, we've been older, we've been able to bond and regain some of our friendship, you know, and especially since she's been going through, her questions with the church and everything like that. It's allowed a little bit more conversation between us.
Okay.
Yeah.
So would you consider yourself a rule follower like Susan?
Well, I mean, for myself, like, we grew up rather, my father had problems with work and business. And so, by the time I was nine, we had gotten, we lost our house and, for the first time. And then, so I grew up, again, with the Bishop's Storehouse, just living off of food like that. And by the time I was 14, I ended my formal education. I never went to school past the eighth grade because I had to stop school and go to work to help support the family. And so for my own personal, like, there was pressure for me, I suppose, to follow the rules, but not so much because there was that tension. I think my parents knew was there because I was also helping win the bread for the family. And so I think they definitely were far more lenient and, on many of the rules I broke. I didn't follow much of the rules during my teenage years because I was working and had a lot of, you know, enmity, you know, towards the church, you know, enmity towards the church and just, the fact that we had been on, church welfare for years. And, you know, I grew up around the fact that my parents, regardless of our financial situation, would always pay our tithing, you know. Mm. They would always give the fast offerings, and having to quit school and seeing them give money to the church was a definite rift in me taking the church a little more seriously than I think some people. I saw them doing that and then seeing that we had no money and then them turning to me and asking from, you know, how many hours I had worked that week. And you know, I think by the time I was 15 or 16, I was working about 42 hours a week. So it was a little bit of a different situation. Again, like, so I took advantage of the fact that they wouldn't press me to follow all the rules. Mm-hmm. And so I poked around a little more at the church, outside of the church, had a look at my friends that weren't members and asked them questions and whatnot. And so there definitely wasn't as much pressure for me that I felt. And that was probably simply because there was that tension of the fact that I don't think my parents wanted to put more pressure on me with the fact that I was working as well at such a young age. So,
did that bother your parents that you were losing interest in the church?
Oh, of course. I'm sure, you know, there's little doubt. My parents were adamant about, you know, every child staying active in the church and, you know, going on missions and getting married in the temple. That was never some sort of hidden agenda. It was out in the open constantly that's what they wanted for us more than anything. So, but although that was there and out in the open, you know, each sibling had a different approach. They had a different approach to how they, you know, with each sibling. With Susan, as she said before, I definitely feel that they put more pressure on her than any of us, the rest of the siblings, the rest of their children. But, so for me, it was there, but not probably as severely as it was for her.
Susan, about this time, it sounds like you were going on a mission. Is that the right timeline?
Yeah, we, like Joel said, it's kind of interesting to hear because, and we've talked about it a little bit before, but our family's always had those financial struggles. And I, by the time when things really came to a head, for me, with that pressure and the pressure of just all the pressure that my parents were putting on me, I couldn't wait to get out of the house. And for me, it's kind of odd that I chose BYU, you know, that I didn't choose, you know, a non-religious school. But for me as well, church was kind of something I leaned on. And I knew BYU would be a kind of a nice cushion for me. It was a place where people believed the same thing I did, which I didn't have during high school. And so it was just, for me, it was my escape. And then going on a mission. Now, I did not want to go on a mission. It was that was kind of a pressure from my mom as well. She, being a convert, just was always like, oh, everybody should go. You know, I hope all my children go on missions, to kind of pay back, you know, what she felt she was given. And I wanted to finish school, but it was kind of odd because the relationship, you know, when I look back to how it was with me and my parents, because it was kind of like they were so like, the gospel is true and all of this. And, but it kind of got to the point where I wanted to be the good child. It's like, well, I'm supposed to be, and so might as well be the good child. And I would, you know, I would really pray about things. And I was definitely true believing all the way. And so when my mom had suggested a mission, I was like, eh, but you know, I thought, well, I better pray about it. And I prayed about it, and I felt really good. I was in a BYU ward, at BYU at the time. And I felt really good about it. So then I didn't mind. Then I was excited. And I actually, the only thing I was worried about was going foreign. Like, I did not want to go on a foreign mission. And I ended up getting called to Oklahoma, which it's kind of funny because when I would tell people that were non-members that I went to Oklahoma, like, they would burst out laughing because it's just, I mean, it's Oklahoma. It was a year after the Oklahoma City bombings that I got my mission call.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was actually on the anniversary, the year anniversary. And so for me, it was like, oh, that's a sign. And so I was really excited to go. When I was on my mission, that was kind of from what I observed from kind of a distance, like when everything just fell apart at home, the sister next to me, she, because, you know, I was the good child, I was the good sister, whatever, she did not want to do anything. She was like completely opposite. And she moved out when she was 15. Isn't that right, Joel? Somewhere around there.
She was about 15.
Yeah. Cause she just did not want to follow any of the rules or deal with any of that pressure. So she kind of went completely the opposite direction of me. And then during my mission is when like my parents lost the house. And so it was, for me, my mission was really hard. It was good. And I'm a pretty easygoing kind of person. And so I got all of the crazy companions, and my mission president even told me, I loved my mission president. He was really good because he, even though I was a rule follower, I felt like I didn't just blindly follow the rules. It was all about like the reasons behind it. And I agreed with those reasons. So then I followed the rules. So on our mission president kind of let it be like, well, you know, do what you think is effective and what, you know, use your heads. And it wasn't just that we had to get up and just tract. Like, tracting was horrible, and as most missionaries think. And of course, in Oklahoma, it was very Baptist. They think they're the Bible Belt, as every Southern state does, uh-huh. You know, and so we actually, on my mission, we did more reactivation than proselyting. That was probably 90% of my mission was reactivation, which I really, that part I really enjoyed. But my mission president told me that, he's like, Sister Mowers, I cannot give these sisters to anybody else but you. And so I got just sisters that had a lot of issues. And that was kind of surprising for me because, I don't know, sometimes I'd like vacillate between being really naive and thinking I was smart. And I thought that sister missionaries were together, like that they were just, because they're older and we got to choose, that they would be different. And boy, was I wrong. And so, you know, with the combination of my companion problems and then just knowing that there were problems at home with, you know, parents losing the house and everything. And, and of course they couldn't pay for my mission. I think people from my ward anonymously donated, you know, cause that was when you would pay into the ward fund, right. And then the ward would pay for you. So when I got home, I actually came home just a month early because it was like I could come home before Christmas or after Christmas. So I was like, get me out of here. I'm going to come home before Christmas. And, you know, but I felt like on my mission that I was really like spiritually nourished And for me, I hadn't gotten married at that point. Obviously, I went on a mission. And so I was just like, oh, this is going to help me be a great mom. Like all this gospel teaching, like I'll know how to teach my children.
On your mission, you're serving the Lord and sacrificing so much. You must have had those times where you thought, I'm giving everything I have and my family's falling apart. Did you ever have those moments of thinking, well, where's my blessing for serving God?
You know, we kind of have like super martyr complex in our family, or at least our parents do. And, you know, I remember getting letters from my mom and it was just kind of like, this is just a test and we have to just, you know, kind of hang in there and the Lord will bless us eventually. And, you know, there's spiritual blessings, not physical blessings. You know, almost in some way it was a little bit like, well, because I'm not getting blessed physically, like we must be like super spiritual giants because we can just, that's how I kind of viewed my family. Like we're just these amazing spiritual giants because we're being faithful and, sacrificing when you don't even, you know, kind of like Job, like you don't see the blessings and you still have to prove that you're faithful. Mm-hmm. So that was the take I had, but at the same time, that was kind of what I told myself. And, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. And it was hard though, because you know, especially just looking back, even because our parents have always struggled. And I mean, our parents are just so devout and it is frustrating to just be like, you know, it was never coming across as far as, you know, that prosperity gospel, right? Where it's like, you just live righteous lives and you'll be blessed. Like in the Book of Mormon, it's like, well, that never really happened. And I feel like it was kind of like, well, I guess it's something we're still not doing. You know, there's something we're not learning. And I don't know, I've heard my mom talk about that. So I think, which is sad because it's like, we're doing all these things and it's still our fault, you know?
Yeah. Sounds like it's Mormon teachings. Sounds all very familiar. Okay. Joe, were you still at home when Susan came home from her mission?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did she try to make you see the light?
You know, she came home, I don't think, if I remember right, Susan, you didn't spend too much time at home. I think you went right back to BYU pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was kind of, again, like, I did not want to be at home. I wanted to get away and get right to school.
I was just working so much at the time that it was kind of a high buy, you know, still working full time. And so we kind of passed our ways and she went to BYU and I went back to work. So, as far as, you know, during the mission while she was gone, you know, there were always, you know, there was always kind of an irony, like, the bishop would come and tell us that, you know, because Susan was on her mission, that, you know, the Lord would bless us and that we'd be, you know, we'd be helped out. And just month after month, it just got worse and worse and worse. And we just had to, had a lot of friends, luckily, my parents did, who were, financially able to help us out. And so instead of just getting kicked out on the streets, we were able to just move around for about every 8 months. We just moved to a different, cheaper, place that we could until my dad was finally able to get some work back, several years later. And we were finally able to kind of get a little bit of stability. So while Susan was gone, it was just very much, just kind of making it week to week.
Yeah, you're on survival.
While everyone's trying to tell us that everything's going to be okay. And we're, you know, I remember as, you know, as being a kid and just thinking, oh, it doesn't look okay so far. You know, when is this going to end? And so it was something I remember my brother watching my father write out tithing and fast offerings for the little money he'd made. You know, at one point he was working six jobs, as janitors. You know, it was just, you know, it was heartbreaking to see, you know, my father who had, had an incredible education, just, you know, mopping floors and scrubbing. And just my brother, I remember one day just came in and saw him, writing money away for the church. And, you know, my brother asked him just, well, you know, who is the money for? And my father said, well, it's to help those who need it. And I remember my brother just, you know, almost broke down just, do we need it? And, it was just heartbreaking to see my brother ask my father, you know, why he was giving this money to people who didn't need it. And, you know, it was something that I learned early on, that the church has a problem with asking for money from those who can't give it. And it's something that creates a crippling dependence on the church. And I saw that in my mission. I've seen that with other members and with many other people. And it's the fact that, you know, when you can't give money, you do. And the idea of this, you know, false dichotomy that you're going to receive the blessings from God for giving it, you know, the parable of the woman who, you know, in the New Testament, they always give as an example that, you know, she gave everything and God would give her everything back, you know, kind of thing. And it just, you know, in real life, it doesn't work out that way, you know. So, you know, we were lucky enough that our parents had some good friends who were willing to look out for us, you know, and when times were about to get really, really tough. And, you know, luckily I was able to work, you know, from the time I was 14 until I was just about to head out on my mission. So that between some of those factors, we were able to stay afloat, stay off the, you know, from being homeless or being put in a shelter.
Oh, that breaks my heart. That is, I can't imagine how frustrating and confusing and scary that must have been for all of you.
Oh yeah, you know, of course it was definitely bewildering. As you get older, you look back and you just kind of wonder, wow, I can't believe that actually happened. You know, that's just what the church teaches. And, you know, the whole point of the gospel, it's not to question it, but to have more faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep believing, don't ask why. And that's a lot of what it comes down to, what it boils down to on the hard line.
Yeah, and just what you said, that the church creates this dependency where give us the little that you have and we'll give you a little bit back and some food or something and we'll tell you if you're going to be okay or not.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's really just unfortunate that they have that system in place, you know, and that not many people will call them out on it.
Well, and I think, you know, when I see, like, it's interesting because I was kind of out of that. Like, I was just, like, off supporting myself. Like, and I paid for my own school and I got student loans and I worked several jobs to support myself. And so, like, I had felt a little bit of that pressure growing up because it was just, it was around, but it didn't, like I said, it didn't happen until really I was on my mission. So I was kind of out of it. And so, but I see, you know, with the reason, you know, my sister had told me one time too that she had talked to our dad about, you know, with the money thing. And it's just this, you know, you put God first. And that was kind of, you know, you just, if you put God first, then everything else is going to fall into place. And, you know, it's almost that thing where they talk about even in the scriptures with, like, you know, where Christ is even like, put me before your family, you know, like, hate your family and love me kind of thing. And I think that our parents didn't mean to have, obviously, they didn't mean that, you know, but they thought they were doing what was best for our family when really what they were doing was just for themselves. I mean, I look at my dad, like Joel was saying, he's just a brilliant man. And he has like no self-confidence in his abilities to support the family because of, you know, what's happened throughout the years. And it's almost just like that was taken away from him, you know, his confidence. Like I said, they thought they were doing what was best, but instead it was, you know, just creating this cycle that just made things, you know, didn't get it, just this vicious cycle.
Yeah, that's rough. That's really hard. Did you ever, you were kind of young to do this, but did you ever look at how the church was spending money and try to make yourself understand that?
I didn't. I think when I was growing up, it was a little different. Like the wards had their budgets and it was like the money that they got from the ward themselves. And we were kind of in a poorer ward as overall, at least from when I was growing up. They moved when I was on my mission, like Joel said, when they lost a house. So I don't know, Joel, you'll have to answer that one a little bit more, I think.
Well, I mean, as far as trying to understand a little bit why, where the money was going and how it was being spent, I mean, it just, I don't think any of us really had the energy to really look into that. Yeah. I didn't get a real glance into it until I was on my mission and actually had to work with on how the church spends its funding.
Okay.
And so I got to see a little more firsthand on how that worked when I was off on my mission.
So how did you go from not having interest in the church to going on a mission?
So, you know, like we mentioned before, like our parents had always, you know, openly just, you know, vocally wanted every child to serve a mission and be, you know, that lifelong active member in the church. Throughout the years of high school while I was working, and in order to cope with the stress, I turned to alcohol. So after between 14 and 19, I was drinking just about every other day in copious amounts to try and cope with it. So I finally went to my parents and told them I had an issue with alcohol, and they recommended that I went to the bishop. You know, he didn't have a lot of good advice. Again, these guys just don't really have any training on drug addiction or any sort of counseling. So he surprisingly, luckily, he pointed me towards AA. So at 18, I went to AA got back on track, started cutting back on the alcohol, and I was able to kind of, you know, get myself, you know, kind of out of the rut. Because some of the members of the church had been a little bit more supportive while I was going through this, I thought, well, maybe I should take another glance at this and see what this is all about. You know, I hadn't really taken it seriously up to then, and so I decided to, well, read the material. I thought I'd read the scriptures, read some of the church writings and doctrine. And then, you know, eventually I just thought, well, you know, I'm probably not going to get a good understanding of whether this is something that's good or true until I, you know, give it a first-hand shot. So I thought, well, a mission is a good opportunity to do that. And so, went through and, went ahead and put in my mission papers. I actually had to, because I didn't want to wait for, all the bureaucratic paperwork that has to go through, including your worthiness to go on a mission and everything. So I simply just lied to go on a mission. I thought, well, you know, regardless of whether I'm worthy, I should be able to see whether everyone else is, from everyone else's fruits and seeing how the church works, I should be able to see how that, see whether it's something I want to, you know, spend my life and dedicate my life to. And so
you went on a mission, not really being dedicated to church, but to see if you should be dedicated.
It was, you know, you know, people had constantly talked about how their missions were amazing, how the people, you know, were phenomenal and that they got to meet amazing people and see people's lives change. And, you know, you hear all these amazing stories and I thought, well, you know, if this is something I want to spend my life doing, then, or if this is something I should take seriously consider, then I'm just going to go and go out there and do my best while I'm there. And I wanted to actually to help out. I did want to actually, you know, convert people and see about that and see how this all worked. I wanted to see whether it was something I wanted to be involved in for the rest of my life. And so, you know, I rushed through as much of the paperwork I could because I just didn't want to wait 1 or 2 years that I knew they would make me wait if I, you know, was frank with them. I just didn't feel that that was necessary. I thought, you know, well, I've been trying to get my life back on track anyways. I don't see why another, you know, 1 or 2 more years is going to make much of a difference, except for maybe I'll lose interest. And then, you know, maybe I might miss out on something after that. So I went ahead and got my mission call. They sent me to Mongolia. And it was one of the things I did want to go also, because I did, unlike Susan, I did want to go foreign. I didn't want to go and see how the church interacted with other Christians. And, you know, America is a very Christian nation. And so I didn't want to go there and just have people validate themselves. And I wanted to see, well, can this actually help others who have absolutely no background, you know, with Christianity, you know? And Mongolia being a third world country, I thought, well, how can it help these people? So I got the call, went ahead and finished the paperwork and got ready to go to Mongolia. Now my mission was actually a little bit different than the typical mission because Mongolia was a communist country, still has a communist parliament at the moment. And so they didn't allow any proselyting. They only approved our visas if we were to teach English. and to work on specific projects with Peace Corps and the Red Cross for digging wells and building houses.
And, do you see that as deceptive as of the church to try to get in that way?
It is 100% deceptive. This is how they get into third world countries that don't want Christian missionaries. And Christian missionaries, whether they're Mormon or a lot of other, they offer their services for helping the environment. But that's not really what they want. They want to go in there and teach people about Christ, you know, so the government will give them the visas and the work permits and everything to go in there as long as they, you know, say they're going to teach English or work with whatever humanitarian aid, projects that are going on. But, the church goes in there knowing, saying, well, you know, what if someone just wants to find out about the church? So they kind of negotiate their way in. Can we build a building? Can we, you know, tell people about our church and get members if they just want to ask us, you know, and so that's how it worked, was very much this underlying deception of like, yeah, we're going in there, you know, on our visas and our paperwork. So it doesn't say you're a missionary. It says you are an English teacher and an aid worker. You're not even licensed to preach. You're not a licensed preacher in that country. They give you a preacher's license and tell you to carry with it, you know, from BYU. They give you that, but it's no good in that country. In Mongolia, they tell you that. They say, you know, like, if you have a preacher's license, they told us when we're getting our work visas that they say, if you have one for America, it's no good here. So if we catch you, we'll boot you back out. That's pretty much how it went. But, you know, that's so that it, instead of creating this, like, understanding between the church and the government, it allowed the church just tried to think of ways around that. They looked for loopholes. And so the focus was never on, what we were told we could do. It was always like, all right, well, how can we get people to become members? How can we talk to people? How do you turn a conversation towards you? How do you get them to ask you to invite, you know, to tell them about, you know, Mormon religion? How do you get them to tell you that they want to be a member? So it was very much based around that.
At first I thought a mission without proselytizing would be great, but now I'm not so sure that it would cause a lot of stress, I think.
Yeah, I definitely headbutt with a lot of people on my mission. And that was another thing that I got to see firsthand, you know, was, you know, in BYU, they, in order to become to be an English teacher, they asked that we were certified from a college. And, I remember at the MTC, they gave us the option to, go through English as a second language, teacher training. They said, it's a 2-week course. If you want to take it, you're here for 12 weeks. You can take it. You don't have to. They said, you're going to get your certificate regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several guys in my group that just didn't go. They didn't care. You know, they thought, well, you know, I can keep working on learning the missionary lessons in Mongolian, or I can, spend time with some of the English as a second language students. Luckily Mike and Cannon wanted to go, and so he and I both agreed, and we went and got our training, you know, the 2 weeks for being, and then the BYU, shipped us some, certifications that's how they certified you as an English teacher there.
And were you ever able to get anyone to ask you about the church?
When I went to Mongolia and we got there in the country and we started working, we were required to register in the police stations of every city or local area, rural area we were in and register where we were going to be teaching English, who we were teaching it to, how many hours we were supposed to register, which humanitarian aid projects we were supposed to be working on. But the problem is, like, you know, it's a third world country. There was a lot of lax laws, and no one was really going to come asking you, you know, did you teach your 20 hours of English, you know, in the middle of Troilus in Mongolia between Irkutsk and China.
Mm-hmm.
And so the missionaries capitalized a lot on that. And I saw that from very early on that they knew that no one was going to go asking around. And so a lot of times they just simply broke the rules and just would start knocking on doors and proselyting. And that was something I had a real problem with, even aside from just going through some of the deceptive manners of trying to trick people to get you to ask them about yourself and that, you know, become interested in a church. It was some of them just flat out broke the law and, went out and just did it anyways. And so I started to butt heads with a lot of companions early on, and I lucked out early on in my mission. My third companion was a really, he was a guy who also left the church eventually. And, he was very adamant about following what he was there to do, you know, by the government, you know, and so we taught lots of English in my early part of my mission. We dug plenty of wells, built houses, and, we didn't teach a single lesson for 6 months. And the mission president found out about it. We were able to get away with that because, we were out in the middle of nowhere, working with some of the smaller cities. But as soon as he found out about it, he actually was going to, kick me off the mission because we hadn't taught any lessons, on the church. And, right before he was about to kick me off and send the paperwork off, he actually had a mild heart attack and had to leave the country.
Wow.
And so I actually stayed on the mission simply because the paperwork, didn't get forwarded on. The new mission president came in and he looked at what was going to be done, and he actually was a much more understanding guy and, you know, said, okay, no, I'm not going to forward this off. You can stay, you know. Mm. And so, you know, I managed to continue, which I wanted to stay. At that point, I'd been working with that companion and we were, you know, I felt we were actually doing some good, and, you know, I felt like, okay, this is actually something I want to continue doing, that it was rewarding to, you know, try and help these people. And I really started to care about them. I didn't want to get kicked off. And so I kind of told myself I'm going to have to try and follow the rules a little bit more, but, you know, it was really difficult.
I just was wondering if you wore a name tag, if you weren't supposed to teach.
We were told that when we were at, they had a list of rules where we could wear name tags. One was they could not be in Mongolian.
So well, what good is it then?
Exactly. So the Mongolian government simply said, you cannot have a Mongolian name tag. The people can't identify you as missionaries because you're not a missionary in the country. That was the whole point of, you know, they said, you know, you're here as an aid worker, as an English teacher. So they immediately told, when the church asked for permission to get Mongolian name tags, they said, no, you can't. And so, some missionaries wore them. I didn't. We all had them. They,
were they in English or Mongolian?
We had both, you know, we weren't, and the church supplied us with both. I don't know why, aside, you know, I can't think of any good, you know, ethical reason to give us, you know, a Mongolian one, when we were strictly told that we shouldn't even have, you know, a Mongolian one. Technically, we could wear the English ones. Yeah, but the church gave us both Mongolian and English name tags, and I guess they just, instead of telling us what we should do, they just kind of left it for us to choose and kind of hoped it wouldn't backfire on them and maybe might get some extra members, you know, if a missionary decided to wear one of the Mongolian tags and people got curious or whatnot. You know, it was very different than your typical mission. It was a far different experience for me, I guess. I really got to see a lot of how the inner workings of the church really trying to build from the ground up does it, you know. You know, these people most of them were Buddhists, but because of the communism that was, you know, so prevalent throughout the history of Mongolia, there was a lot of atheism too. A lot of people just didn't believe in God because the Russians for years had just been, you know, no religion. But, you know, a lot of the old roots were in Buddhism. And so just Christianity, explaining Christianity to Buddhists and to any other missionaries who've gone to Buddhist countries know that there's just concepts that some people, they confuse them so easily and they don't understand, and they don't teach you how to explain it well when they do ask questions, you know. You know, it's something that it's embedded in culture too. And so you're not just trying to, you wouldn't be just trying to convert someone to an idea. It was so much you're trying to separate them from their culture.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how that would be. And I also have a hard time understanding. I know the church gets a lot of help, but I have a hard time understanding why they think they can go in and try to tell a Buddhist/atheist communist that they're doing everything wrong and they need to be baptized. I don't really know how that would work. Were you able to get any baptisms?
You know, I think I had maybe a couple. There was maybe one or two.
That's about how many I had in Oklahoma, so it doesn't
Oh, really?
But I mean, surprisingly, it was actually, I was the anomaly. A lot of people had usually around 20 or 30 baptisms, but, you know, they were teaching children most of the time, and that's another can of worms. I mean, most of the times the parents just didn't care, and the missionaries would ask the parents loosely if they wouldn't mind their children being baptized. You know, and the problem was, of course, that, you know, the Mongolians, they saw these Americans as kind of like the idea of prosperity. They're going to help us go to America. They're going to help us, you know, learn English. They're going to help us do this. And the church wasn't willing to do any of that. They just wanted more baptisms. And so I remember, you know, I was a branch president in one of the cities for a bit. And, you know, we had about 20 or 30 members and, just over 20 of them. I think we had like 26 members in that branch. And, about 20 of them were, little girls, you know, age 11. And it just disgusted me that, the missionaries were resorting to tactics of, you know, just not even being honest with, you know, the parents of what their children were getting into, what the church really wanted. You know, like, how does a little 11-year-old girl know how to make a decision that's supposed to be so important?
Well, and it doesn't even really benefit the church, because if the parents aren't interested, the child's not going to keep going.
But, it didn't benefit the church, but the problem is the way that how the bureaucratic paperwork and, you know, like, leadership works is it's all based on numbers. And so when you have baptisms, you get funding. The more funding you get, the more, you know, whatnot. So you can apply for building permits. You can apply for land purchases when you have a certain amount of members.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah, absolutely. And so and obviously they'll say, like, well, okay, you need a certain amount of men. Okay, well, then there would be a huge push to try and get a certain amount of priesthood holders and people who were potential priesthood holders. And so it was a numbers grab the entire time. A numbers grab to get approval from Salt Lake for various things, whether again it was purchasing land for a future stake center or for whatnot. And so the focus was always on just the growth. It wasn't on the people, and this doesn't mean that I didn't meet, there were plenty of wonderful companions and people I met while on my mission that, you know, really did care about the people, really did try hard. But it wasn't necessarily, I realized at that young age that it wasn't because they were Mormon, it was because they were good people. You know, their upbringing had, you know, between their upbringing and what they cared about, you know, they understood what was, you know, what was right and wrong. And they, you know, they were good people because that's who they were. It wasn't, you know, just because they were Mormon. And so I learned early on in my mission that the church, while it may have done some good things, and there were good people in it who were trying to do good things, its focus wasn't where mine wanted to be, and that being a part of it wasn't going to make me a better person or help other people. I could help other people without the church.
Okay.
I could be a good person without the church. And so I learned that really, you know, early on in my mission, and it was pretty much solidified by the time I got off my mission. More or less left the church pretty much right after.
Oh, really? About how long do you think it was?
I stopped going to church about, you know, 2 months after I got back from my mission.
Wow.
And, you know, a couple of years later, I formalized it by sending my resignation letter forwarding to my bishop that I wanted my name removed.
Was this the same bishop that was there when you went on your mission?
No, this was a different bishop. Yeah, something I knew because I had been familiarized with all the paperwork, the tactics the church has. When I knew I wanted to completely leave the church, one of the things they try and do is get you in to meet with people and talk to people, try and convince you not to go. And I just felt that was disrespectful to my decision. And so when I knew, you know, I knew the loopholes through their own paperwork, which was simply, you know, you can, you know, for anyone who wants to have their name removed, you don't have to meet with anyone. You don't have to go to any meetings. You don't have to go through. You can simply send the letter, you know, declaring that you're no longer a member the moment they get it, you know, and that if they have any contentions, this is based on your Fourth Amendment rights, and just to forward you know, the letter on to Salt Lake without delay, you know, rescinding any sort of, you know, time limit. And so I didn't want to have to go through any more of, you know, the organizational part of it. I knew that I could just send off a letter and be done. And that was really what I wanted in the end.
And is that what happened?
That is, and that was something that, you know, my parents, a lot of my family just, you know, I think had a hard time. I'm sure, Susan, you probably had a hard time understanding why I wanted to leave.
Yeah, what happens, Susan, when your returned missionary brother all of a sudden wants to have no part of it?
You know, it was definitely interesting because one sister had already left, but she, like we said, you know, she moved out when she was 15. That was pretty much when she left. She formalized it, yeah, maybe 5 years ago, maybe around the time you did, Joel.
Probably.
But she was pretty much out. And so I had a sibling that wasn't, but definitely to have, you know, and I didn't know any of this had gone on, you know, I didn't really understand. And also I think part of it was our age difference. You know, we just weren't close. It wasn't until I got home from BYU and he was home from his mission and we were all kind of like all my siblings and I, we were all more adults that we really started to actually become friends. And so I knew from my own experience. I mean, I don't know if my family, like, I don't know if Joel knew how hard my mission was for me just emotionally. I mean, I had good experiences on my mission, but I knew coming home, like I had a really hard time coming home, I think, with everything, with being so in kind of in chaos with our family's financial situation and stability that I missed the stability of my mission. And so, you know, like, I don't know, I remember writing Joel letters like, this is, you know, I know it's going to be hard when you come home. And I thought it was going to be more hard, like, spiritually and all these things. And I just didn't have a clue. And it was very confusing when Joel decided to, you know, like, I remember just seeing, you know, he really wasn't going to church. We were both in the singles ward at that time. Cause by that time I'd graduated from BYU unmarried. So, you know, what else to go but the singles ward. And I knew that he had stopped wearing his garments, but I think when you're a member, you're confused, but you really aren't, there's no way you can understand, because I remember talking to Joel and him saying like, hey, you know, if you have any questions, you can ask me anything. And I didn't really quite know what to ask. I think part of me didn't want to ask, you know, certain things. You know, really in the back of my mind, it was like, well, he just must have misunderstood things or maybe, you know, something happened where maybe he didn't really have a test. You know, all those things that we think of as members with people who leave, you know, we don't think that it could be what it really is. We always think, oh, maybe they just didn't have a testimony. When, you know, of course, now talking to my brothers and sisters, like Joel, I mean, everybody read the Book of Mormon and prayed. And I mean, they really tried. And so it really wasn't any of that. I with Joel, it was kind of like I saw Joel and then our other brother left about the same time or maybe before. I don't know. You'll know more, Joel, with, you know, what happened with our other brother, but because I know, because they're really close. And so I just remember kind of being like, oh, and for me, it was almost, again, just this kind of like, oh, I've got to just, you know, I've got to be the stalwart daughter. And for me at that time, so I, like I said, I'd left BYU. I wasn't married. I was just like, I need to get married. Like that, for me, after my mission, that was my focus. Like, I need to get married and, you know, start living the rest of my life. And it's kind of funny when you think about it. It's like, I couldn't live life before I was married. You know, I had to be married in order to have a life. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, very much the focus. And as a single woman in church, the older you get, like the more it becomes an issue to I mean, I came home from my mission. I went to BYU for a couple more years. I came back home. I was 25 when I graduated from college and moved back to Reno. I wasn't really planning on moving back to Reno, but that's just kind of how things were. It's my hometown, and I had connections for internships and things. And it was good because then, like we'd said, you know, I could get to know all my brothers and sisters that, you know, we just didn't really grow up together. And so I was probably in every singles war that has been here in Reno. And, you know, it just was more and more pressure to, okay, keep dating, be involved in activities. You know, I kind of felt like I was in perpetual young women's, you know, where you're just like, you know, you're in your upper 20s and you're doing stuff that you did when you were 16.
Did you have activity nights and stuff, that kind of thing?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it was just, it's ridiculous. Yeah, I mean, you're having the same old, like, let's go bowling and, you know, and just these things. And then when I hit 30, my singles ward bishops, they were kind of like, you can stay. You know, like, they didn't want to see me leave. They really wanted to get me married. There was one of the bishops that, and he was, they were wonderful men, but they just, you know, what advice are they going to give to a, you know, 20-something single girl?
Were they trying to play matchmaker, or are they just trying to guide
all the time? And it got to the point where one of our bishops, he just knew, like, you do not talk to me about that. Like, whenever we would go in for interview, I would go in for interviews, you know, at first it'd be like, oh, look at the wall. You know, they'd have, in the bishop's office, they'd have the wall of, like, all the members, like, in the different callings, whatever. He's like, just tell me what guy. I'm like, you know. And I'm like, that is not going to happen. And finally got to the point, I'm like, don't even mention it. Because it just makes you feel, I mean, it really just makes you feel horrible as a person. Uh-huh. When that's the only focus. And it's like, as a girl, especially, I think, it's like, I know I'm not married. I know I'm not dating, you know. And dating, when you get, I mean, it's already restrictive as far as, you know, dating only members and blah, blah, blah. Well, when you get older, it just gets weirder. And, I mean, one bishop, he was like, okay, we're going to pray and fast and you go to the temple every week. And I'm telling you, in 6 months, you'll be married, you know? And so I'd have these kind of weird prophecy promises stuff and nothing would happen. And when I hit in my 30s, there's that, a new thing that's been, you know, kind of starting up, and you probably have it in Utah a lot more, the mid-singles, you know? And so it's like, okay, well, everybody that got married really young is now divorced and has a few kids, and, you know, they're there for round two or three, you know?
Sounds real fun.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and it just gets wearing over time. I mean, it's so many, I would just cringe, you know, when my friends, they'd be like, all right, we're going to go to some singles conference in California. And first I was excited. I mean, I should back up. When I heard about mid-singles, I was really excited because there had to be something, you know. You can only be in the young singles ward for an extend for so long, you know. By the time I'm in my early 30s and mid-30s, like, I decided to go to a family ward because just, I couldn't be in a young single ward where everybody was, you know, in their early 20s and going to college. I just didn't fit. And so then when I heard about this mid-singles program, well, I took it to, I connected, because of course there's all the, like, online Mormon dating sites and everything, and the world gets kind of like, probably like the ex-Mormon community, you know, you kind of all learn about each other and you're like, oh, okay. So I'd connected with some people in California who had started some mid-singles programs, and they gave me all sorts of tips on how to get one started in Reno. And so I went to the stake president, who, of course, ironically, was one of my singles ward bishops. So he was all for it because, you know, anything to get Susan married, you know, or any of the other singles married. So for, gosh, 2 or 3 years, I was just super like, let's get this mid-singles program going. And it was just pulling teeth. and just and going to and the activities. I mean, we get maybe two or three people, and they were always the people that you didn't really have anything else in common, and they were very socially capable. And so, I'm socializing with people where I'm just, they're not people that I would socialize with, and trying to be supportive and doing all these things. And then it was kind of crazy too, because I'd get a lot of people to hear about this kind of program, and I would get random calls, people yelling at me for not having enough activities or this or that.
Oh, jeez.
I know, it was ridiculous. And I mean, I let those just kind of roll off and just like, whatever, you know, if you want more activities, you are welcome to come and help.
Did you ever think of dating a non-Mormon?
Well, and that's what naturally just ended up happening, because when I'm a cute girl. And so, you know, just out and about, just in life, grocery store, whatever, guys would ask me out. And sometimes I'd say yes, and sometimes I'd say no. You know, it was hard for them too, because dating in the church is, it gets in this weird vortex of like just marriage, 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 right? And all that pressure to just get married. And so you're entering dating relationships with a very, you know, this thing just hanging over your head.
No pressure, but you're going to be my eternal companion.
Yeah. And so you're sizing up people like right away, and they're sizing up you, and you go to these conferences or whatever, and there's 50 million girls and, you know, five guys. And, and if there's a guy that's semi-normal, you know, oh my goodness. But dating non-members was definitely less pressure. But at the same time, on that side, it was very much like, well, when are we going to have sex? And so it was very no-win situation, the older I got. But I got to a point where I was, and then, you know, but speaking of sex, you know, when you're older and you're in your 30s and you're a virgin, it just, you can't keep that up for too long. I mean, that's a hard one that really became a focus, as far as it's just like, you can't have sex. Okay, I gotta get married because I cannot hold out much longer. And, you know, a lot of my friends who were in the same boat that I was.
Did you talk about it openly with them?
We would. Well, as openly as we could. I mean, we would laugh about it. We'd be like, man, when we get married, the guys are gonna have to hold us back, because it, you know. You hear these stories of these young girls who, you know, get married at 19 or 18 or 20 or whatever. And they, you know, sex is like, it's scary. We were just like, we cannot wait. Now, of course, this is just things you hear, you know, but for us, we were just like, we cannot wait. And we'd all dated non-members, and we'd all had more semi-sexual experiences, I guess, you know, by the time you're 35. It's kind of hard to not have something.
Yeah.
And I remember going still to these dating conferences or whatever, and they're still talking about, I mean, things are very chastity based, like you're 16, and it's like, I'm not 16. And I wasn't married. Like, I don't know how the people who'd been married and had sex and then got divorced and then had to go back to, like, you know, Zippo. I mean, for me, it was like, it's all still fantasy land, you know, for them, they know what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the more I got into my 30s, I think, you know, in my 20s, I was just gung-ho in the gospel. And I think that's why, and even my early 30s, why with Joel or my other family members, I had a hard time understanding why they were leaving. But as I got older, there was just no place for me, you know, as a single woman. And it wasn't even like I was divorced and had kids, because even those women in Relief Society or whatnot, they were single moms. They had their kids to talk about and those things. And so in some of my wards, you know, I'd been in some where, you know, they were good and they tried to embrace me. Others, I was just kind of an anomaly.
It sounds, you know, like you were lonely. Is that too strong of a word?
No, I think that's completely appropriate. There was no support system for me. the older I got, friends, you know, when you're older, friends move away, they get married. Some of them did, or they, you know, a lot of my girlfriends, if they didn't get married, they moved to different places to get jobs or whatever. I mean, you got to support yourself when you're single. And my only social outlet was the mid singles, which, you know, that just was nothing, but you know, it was just shitty.
The group that you started.
Yeah, exactly. Which I passed the torch to someone else, and you know, because I was just like, I can't do this anymore. And it just, there was just nothing. And I really struggled with just feeling like, you know, for so long, it was like, okay, I guess I'll just get married in the millennium or, you know, all of those things. But especially over this past year, it was more just, why would God set up this system that was kind of like set for you to fail? Kind of like with the finances. It's kind of like everything. I think sometimes with church, it's a system that sets you up to depend on it, but not reward you with anything. And I was just, I had pretty much stopped going to church maybe a year and a half to 2 years ago. I would go maybe sporadically. I mean, I remember, you know, my mom would always just be like, are you going to church? And just can't quite make myself go. I mean, I was still believing. I felt really guilty about not going. But I just, there was nothing for me. And I was really trying. I mean, and I was praying so hard. I was like, Heavenly Father, you know, send me a friend, just somebody. I had no visiting teachers. I didn't have anything. And I remember some sister missionaries came by once, and I was just so ecstatic to see them because I was like, oh, I, you know, somebody to come and visit. I was so used to having my support structure in this church. Like, I didn't really think or understand how to go out and get friends. I mean, now I'm in meetup groups or this, you know, I do different things where it's like, oh, I have friends that I have common interests with that have nothing to do with church. But I was, it was kind of that last clinging hope of, well, I guess I should just, you know, it must be something that I'm doing wrong, that I'm just not spiritual enough. I'm not going to church, so that's my fault. I'm not reading my scriptures. That must be my fault. That's why I'm not feeling supported or anything like that. And so it just kind of came to a head where I was living with, the sister who's next to me, who left when she was 15. And so we actually reconnected and we lived together for a year and we still live together. But just talking with her and getting, just seeing, you know, how she viewed her spirituality, she kind of went on a different journey where she's very spiritual in how she thinks that, in her ways. They're kind of more new age, like Eastern philosophies and things, but it was good to live with someone who, you know, we could talk about those things. And so for me, I finally just was like, you know, I'm fighting to do something that it's just not serving me. And I kind of just gave myself permission. Well, for me, a lot of it had to do with my sexuality too, and my body image, and, you know, not getting married, and all of these things were just kind of swirling in my head. Like, I mean, I just really had such low self-esteem, and it got to the point where I was so depressed that I'm like, I just can't keep being this way. And so I decided one day just to try taking my garments off. And whenever I'd have to put them on, it was like, ugh. You know, just that part of me was like, oh, okay, covering up my body. You know, it just kind of like took away part of my identity as a woman. And so when I decided, like, I'm just going to go to work and not wear them and just see how it feels. And it was like freaking out halfway, you know, like, oh my gosh, I'm going to hell. I should be wearing my garments. But then the other part was like, this is amazing. And then from there, I kind of just decided to, you know, that, hey, if I believe that my brothers and sisters who are not members, God still loves them. And I believe that, like with Joel and my other siblings that had left. I thought, you know, one day they could come back and Heavenly Father would bless them. And I really believed that they would all come back eventually. And so I thought, well, if I believe that for them, then I should extend that same kind of belief for me. And perhaps it's time that I really get out there and explore. And so from that, I just kind of gave myself permission to read things. And I never really knew about the whole, all these Mormon podcasts, you know, these post-Mormon podcasts or whatever.
How did I?
You know what? I was seeing stuff on Facebook, like with Kate Kelly. Like that was the big hubbub of, you know, what people would be posting about. And so I had started reading, I don't even know where I got this book. I read Bart Ehrman's Misquoting Jesus. And that was like, whoa. Like for me, that was a big wow. And then I think from there, I just was like, well, I knew that there was post like anti-Mormon, I should say, now I know it's post-Mormon, but you know, in my mind, it was like all this, you know, anti-Mormon stuff. And I was like, well, let's just, I think I Googled something with Kate Kelly and I came across a podcast that they were talking about it. And then from there, I just, and then the podcast, you guys all mention each other, you know, it's like, oh, there's this and oh, and I was doing this, you know, somebody will mention something and so it's like, oh, well, I'll check out that podcast. And so I've pretty much listened to, of course, Mormon Expression, Mormon Exposer, Infants on Thrones, Mormon Stories, Mormon Matters, Mormon, I don't know, you know, then I'm hearing about all these things, Sunstone. And, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, there's this whole other world. And so at first it was kind of scary, but then I started just exploring more. And then, of course, I was able to then ask like Joel and my other siblings and just be like, okay, so I'm having these questions. And of course they had all sorts of books and things, you know, Joel gave me, you know, check out this YouTube channel or check out this person or, you know, check out this book. Cause you know, he had done that years before. And, you know, now I'm going through the same process as we all do. You know, we kind of all read the same books, listen to the same things, kind of just deconstructing. You know,
this is all fairly new for you.
It is. It's been within the past year.
Wow. And did you, I know when I went through it, I kind of felt like I had to look over my shoulder and make sure no one was watching me. Did you get those feelings?
Not so much. Once, for me, actually, the two main things in my mind is once I told myself that I was going to give myself permission and I knew that God would be, I had believed in a more, the more I saw with my brothers and sisters, we all had different beliefs, but we all still stayed very close. The more I believed in a more merciful, loving God. And so once I decided to apply that for myself, that was a huge thing. And then like once I read Misquoting Jesus, that was a big one where I thought, well, maybe God doesn't even exist, you know? And for me, it was kind of like, okay, that's a new one. You know, I had my grieving where it was kind of like, oh, I miss God. You know, I miss having someone to pray to, but I kind of just told myself that, you know, I'm going to just give myself the space to not know for a while. And then that's okay. And I'm still kind of in that space. You know, I'm exploring different things, meeting with a therapist to work through, you know, my faith transition, which has been helpful.
Yeah, I highly recommend that myself.
Yeah.
Joel, what did you think when Susan showed up and started asking questions?
Well, I guess it was a bit of a surprise. I didn't know it was, you know, again, we probably hadn't been too close as over the years, but we were slowly building up more of a relationship. So when she finally came to me, it was, I think we were definitely close enough where we both felt comfortable, you know, her asking me questions and me being able to, you know, speak more freely and openly with her than I had probably in years. And so it was actually, you know, it was wonderful to be able to, you know, get a little bit more in depth of a relationship with my sister, just, you know, get to know her a little bit more. And, you know, that she was so eager to get to know me a little bit more. It was really, you know, it was surprising and it was really nice to be able to see that, she had questions and that I could be there to help her out, you know, So I guess it was just, when you're a sibling and, or when you're part of a Mormon family and you leave the church, you always feel some sort of disconnect between those who are active and those who are just, who aren't active anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's always that sort of, uncrossable bridge that you can't quite reach. And so when something repairs that and something bridges that so you can talk again openly, it's amazing to be able to, you get a friend back. You know,
yeah.
you can really be open, you can be honest, and there's no eggshells to step over, you know, there's no elephant in the room anymore. So it really helps open up things, you know, and it's something that you just, it's just unfortunate. I know so many people who've just had that experience of, you know, once they've left the church or they've had disagreements with it, you know, it just creates just this rift between them and their friends or family. And
yeah.
It's just heartbreaking.
I've experienced that myself, and even if it's something that I don't really want to talk about or I don't think it's necessary to talk about, if I know I can't talk about it, it does kind of build a barrier.
Yeah, of course, it does. And so with Susan, it was very much when she started coming to me to talk to me about her experience and asking me questions, it was, you know, that barrier just kind of got swept away. And, you know, it was nice to be able to say, oh wow, you know, like we have a new stage of friendship now. You know, we can be really open and honest. You know, she was able to be much more honest with me, which was wonderful. I could get to know her more. And, again, I could do the same for her. So, it was nice to be able to have that barrier swept away. We could really be honest with each other and open.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's actually for me, I know with each of my siblings leaving, it was shocking for my parents as they kind of just, you know, dropped like flies, you know, as years went on. But at the same time, because of they'd almost like paved the way for me. So for me, my faith transition has been fairly smooth because I've had, you know, so many supports from them. And, you know, with Joel, especially because he did go on a mission, he did go to the temple. So there was more, some of our other siblings didn't, you know, they left when they were younger and whatnot, and they didn't have those experiences. So it was helpful. I mean, like talking about the garments and talking about different things. With Joel was really helpful because he'd experienced some of those things on that level that I had. And then, you know, for me, for me telling our parents, it was, I think everybody was kind of shocked because like our one sister who's still active in her parents, because I always was that, like, I'm the dumb good girl, you know, like I was always the, all right, I'm in it forever. And once I allowed myself that space, but because I think even though there was, like Joel said, and there was, you know, there was always that space of disconnect, yet despite it, I think our families always tried to maintain our relationships. And I know I'd had even bishops and state counselors and things be very surprised when, you know, I'd mentioned that I'd have family members who are not, you know, who'd even left the church, like removed their records, but, you know, we still were friends and got along and I still loved them and cared for them. You know, that is not always what happens. There wasn't any shunning. There, you know, there's uncomfortableness and things, and there's just things in our family we would know not, you know, we just wouldn't go there. But because there was still that bond of, you know, we really still cared about each other, even though there was something that we couldn't always talk about. But I think that really helped. So for me this past year, because that bridge was already built as far as that, just that bridge of knowing that everybody loved me and that I loved them. With my siblings, then when I had my questions, and I had all sorts of questions and, you know, detailed questions and things, it was much easier for me, I think, than it's been for any of them.
So your parents know that you aren't going to church now?
Yeah. They knew, I mean, obviously they knew that I wasn't really going to church, but they know now it's more of a, like, I told them, taking a break. You know, for me in my mind, I know it's not a break. But, you know, I just told them I needed to step back from the beliefs, you know.
Do you think you'll remove your name like Joel did?
I probably will. I know for mostly for my parents. Like, it'll be a few years. Like, there's no hurry for me right now to do it. I think the more I've studied about different things, like one book that I just recently was reading that I really liked was called Recovering Agency.
Oh, I've heard of that one.
Yeah. It was, for me, it was really helpful to see because to kind of unravel, like, why did I believe all these things and why was I so adamant about these things? And really just to see how, you know, any system, whether it's religion or whatever, you know, there's just some emotional manipulations that go on. And to see some of those and go, you know, that's what's going on. And that helped me to have more empathy for my parents because, like Joel said, it was, you know, for so many things, it's like, and even when I, like when I told my dad recently that, you know, I was taking a break, he said some things that were just more victim blaming. Like, you know, it's kind of like, well, it's my fault that I'm struggling. It's not the church's fault, you know, and at first I was like, that's just, you know, and I called him out on it. I'm like, no, that's not necessarily true. But reading that book helped me to see like how he's kind of caught in that, you know, just the system, it self-perpetuates, it makes victims, it creates them and they self-perpetuate. And so for me, that's been a helpful book just to kind of help myself and help me to see where my parents are and why they're kind of in that so much, you know, just so deep into that, into their beliefs. You know, with my mom, when I told her, she was good. And she actually, we sat down and she said, you know, she asked me questions. And I mean, she asked me, you know, do you believe in Jesus Christ? That's her main thing. I mean, she's all about Jesus. And, you know, I said, not right now or not in the way I used to. And I know that was hard for her to hear, but it was nice for me to be able to say it and for her to just hear it and not try to talk me out of it or anything like that. So, yeah.
So it sounds like overall it's, things have gone as well as they could have with your family.
Yeah. Like I said, I think I couldn't have been at this place when I was young. I never would have been able to break away. I could have only done it the way my sister did it, which was, you know, just to completely rebel against everything and move out. And I just wasn't that wasn't in my DNA to do that. So for me, it's been a blessing, even though I'm the oldest to be almost the last to leave. It's been really, really good.
Well, good. This is kind of a random question, but I was thinking about this earlier today, that the longer I'm out of the church, I'll look back at some of the things that I used to believe, and they just now seem so absurd that it's just hysterical. I just have to laugh. Have you guys, either of you, had that experience?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Can you give an example, Joel?
Oh, gee. Yeah, I mean, I think probably one of the most, one of the most silly beliefs, I guess, I've ever been able to try and wrap my brain around is just how many people Joseph Smith said he spoke with. I mean, the guy couldn't stop with an angel. He had angels, God, Jesus Christ, John the Baptist, Peter, James, John, and Moses, Elijah. I always think of that. I just kind of think, you know, why did he stop there? You know, like how many more names did he want to add to the list? If you're going to go out with a bang, you know, might as well throw in a few more of the greats. And so I always think of that, you know, and it just makes, I can't help but laugh just to, you know, how many people, the guy said he met with, and like no one stopped asking, like, are you sure? You met with Moses.
There had to be someone that said to him, no, Joseph, you did not talk to
Joseph,
him.
You already said Elijah last time, you know, and the three apostles and James and John the Baptist. All right, how many poor guys are you going to add to this list? I'm just, you know, Joseph just always at the table, you know, with a beer in his hand, just like, all right, just guess who I met last night, you know, it's always just been a bit of a thing that just makes me laugh. It's just too ridiculous to take seriously.
Well, and there would be people in the same house, and if, like you said, the next morning he's saying, "Oh, I talked to so-and-so," you'd be like, "Last night in our house?"
Yeah, I know.
Across the room from me? What?
While I was sleeping? Yeah.
So that's always one of the things that comes often to my mind when some of the Mormon beliefs pops in my head. I just find that just too unbelievable to take seriously.
Yeah, and the more you read history, you see where a problem will arise, and suddenly Joseph gets a revelation. Another problem, Joseph gets a revelation. It's so convenient.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you're writing the rules, it's pretty easy to make them up.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, same question for you, Susan. Can you think of anything?
You know, I think for me, now I'm surprised at how, like, the feminist issues, like, really just pop out to me. And I'm just like, what was I thinking? Because I remember with like, the ordained women, at first I was like, no, women have separate roles and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we grew up in a kind of a feminist household. Our mom kind of ran the show, and it wasn't patriarchal at all. And so I always felt like I was a feminist, but then I see the things, I'm just like, holy crap, like, what did, you know, I can't believe that I just didn't recognize all of the things with women in the church, you know, just from either I just ignored it or I just didn't see it in that light, you know. I was kind of, it's like, oh, I always thought I was so special, but it's like they were just telling us that just to, like, shut us up. You know, oh, you're special. Now go sit in the corner. We love you so much. We made the corner very special for you. You know, it's like, you know, with the temp, everything from the temple to, you know, and even for me, I don't know. I really, not even with Mormonism, but, like, I have such an issue with the Adam and Eve story. Like, I just hate that story now. I don't know. I just think it's just, you know, this whole thing. And then they had to, you know, cover their nakedness when they left the garden, and it just seems so ridiculous.
Yeah, and childbirth is the punishment for women for what Eve did. I can't believe I ever just went, oh, okay.
Yeah, it was like, okay, well, I guess, you know, wanting to, you know, it's like, oh, it was such a wonderful thing that Eve did, but she was really punished, you know, and it's like.
Yet it was part of the plan, but she was in trouble.
Yeah, it was something you're supposed to do, but we're going to punish you for it. Like, I see that in just so many things, but it just, even just, it's almost like, it's very how it was with the civil rights movement, I think, you know. It's like, we will give you, you know, we'll have our token woman at ward council, and, you know, and just these things, and you're like, okay, but we don't really say anything. We're just supposed to be pretty and get married, and I just could never do that.
But I even question if we're supposed to be pretty, because you mentioned the temple, and in the temple there's the part where the women have to veil their faces.
Yeah.
And you just do it, and I didn't even think about it. I'm just like, okay. And now I'm like, what? Why would I think that was okay? I mean, if I showed up at my job and they told me to veil my face, I'd be like, you want me to what?
Yeah. Exactly. And the whole, like, I mean, growing up, it was always like, you can do whatever you want as long as it's being a mom. You know? And yeah, so now to not have to think that way, it's like, oh, I can be a woman and not have to eventually be submissive to some guy.
Joel, are you married now?
Oh, no. No, I'm still single.
So if you happen to fall in love with a Mormon girl, do you think by your laugh, I guess that's not even a possibility.
Well, you never know, I suppose. I'm not going to make any future predictions.
I just don't see that.
Yeah, I guess looking back, I can only think just what else can you expect from a bunch of 70 or 80-year-old white men, you know, making up all the rules for these women. You know, it's just so ridiculous. I think it was just a couple of years ago they had the whole incident with the women wearing pants in church.
Yeah, that was.
If I remember hearing something about. I think it made one of the some a couple it made some major news because I don't remember hearing about it anywhere else. But
yeah, I think I heard that 3 years ago. I think.
Yeah, I heard that and just couldn't help but laugh. Just yeah, I wanted to see what they were going to say to that. Like, you know, how were they going to handle that? No, you don't. We don't mind if you wear pants, but please don't wear pants.
Yeah,
just like. Well, okay, you know, let's, you know, open mouth, insert foot. Let's see how you handle this one.
Okay.
So.
Do you miss the priesthood, Joel?
Nope, I'm afraid I don't.
All right, so where would you say you both stand today? Joel, are you a believer in God? What are your beliefs?
You know, over the years, I've done a lot of just reading of religious texts and science texts and numerous history books. And you know, at the moment, you know, for the last several years now, I've been an atheist, so.
Okay. How about you, Susan?
I guess I'm kind of agnostic. Like I said, right now, I don't really know. I'm kind of into the, like, I think there's, you know, there's something to deal with. I mean, we're conscious of our lives and that's got to come from somewhere. Where, I don't know. And I'm okay with that. You know, I don't think I have to know the answers. One thing that I think is kind of neat for me, once I almost let go of God being there and being in charge of my life, it was scary not having that. But at the same time, it's like, oh, I don't have to wait for God to do something with my life or that something's not happening because God doesn't want it to happen. It's like, oh, I can just make my own decisions. And it's like, I kind of was able to reclaim my life. And I guess I'm a little humanist in the fact it's like, instead of just being like, oh, well, I guess life here isn't going to be great or I'm not going to get married or whatever it is, I'll just wait for the next life. It's like, no, I can, because I don't know if there's a next life or not. I only can focus on now. And so it, for me, it's making life more rich because I don't know what's, you know, out there. I hope something is, but I can't know. I won't know. I'll probably never know. You know, it's how can we know? It's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess a little agnostic, a little deist, a little, there's some things kind of thrown in the mix there, but mainly the focus on just, I have to live now.
Sometimes it's kind of nice not having to know and not having to know right now.
Yeah.
And just, you know, if you can be what you feel is right and not have pressure that if you don't do this and this and this, you're not going to be found worthy in your next interview.
Yeah. I think the thing too that's kind of crazy is, I mean, everything was so certain before. You know, there's part of me that misses that certainty, but at the same time, there's part of me that was really enjoying, like, because I don't know, that there's all sorts of things for me to explore.
Yeah, there are times I can miss the checklist, like, oh, if I do this and this and this, I know I'm okay. But then I think, do I want to go back to that? And I think, no way am I ever going back to that.
Yeah. There's no way in hell that I'm going back.
I'm making adult decisions for the first time, and I don't know. It's an interesting turn of events that I would never have expected.
When your life's kind of planned out, even if it doesn't go according to plan, and you try, for me, it was like always trying to make it fit the plan that, you know, the one size fits all. One size does not fit all.
Okay. So, Joel, do you have any advice for somebody that's thinking of taking a break or leaving the church?
Oh, yeah. Do it. My first advice, just do it. You know, there's always some sort of backlash, I guess, you worry about. And I guess my advice would be just don't worry about that. You know, it's if you are not allowed to have a different idea or a different opinion, then there's something wrong with the ideas and opinions you're holding to. You know, if you can't branch out from that or even look at it or take a break from it, then something's wrong. You know, you can't have a dictatorship over how you think. If you're thinking of taking a break, just do it. You know, it doesn't have to be forever, but don't worry about the backlash. Worry about that after. It's important to be able to take a look at something objectively. you have to be able to do that with any ideas and with any sort of ideology you have.
Great. And Susan, same question. Do you have any advice?
I guess, you know, kind of for me it was, and I would say to someone else, like, if you still are worried about, you know, what God thinks, I'm not sure if I believe in God right now, but when I did, it was like I knew that he's a lot more loving and merciful than you think. So give yourself a break. And yeah, and like Joel said, like, give yourself the space. Like, it's okay to take a break, and it doesn't have to be forever. You know, we have where these things are so black and white in church. You know, it's like one decision is the rest of your life. And it doesn't have to be that way, you know. Sometimes a decision can just be for a space of time, and that's okay. So give yourself that space. And the other thing for me, I love that book, Recovery and Agency. Like, if I could recommend out of all the books I've read for me to help me understand my beliefs, that was the one. So read it.
Nice. Very nice. Okay. Well, I really appreciate you both taking the time. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, no. Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I just have to shout out to my brother. He did this to support me, even though it's been a while for him. So I really appreciate that.
Aw, you know, way to go,
Joel. You did this. Yeah.
It was a pleasure.
I was like, I know it's been a while for you, but would you come on Voices?
Nice. Well, I'm glad you both did. And if you also want to be on Mormon Expression Voices, I'd love to hear from you. You can send me an email at voices@mormonexpression.com. And I will talk with one of you or all of you soon.
Sudden coincidence.